Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents The Book of the Black Earth by John Sprunk. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Thomas Keegan, Nora Ashrati, Colleen Delaney, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, Christopher Sheeran, Andy Clements, Tim Getman, Bradley Smith, Christopher Walker, Michael John Casey, David Jordan, James Lewis, John Dow, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, Jeff Allen, Kimberly Gilbert, Alyssa Wilmoth, Steve Wanall, David Coyne, Nanette Savard, Scott Graham, James Konacek, Drew Kopas, Dylan Lynch, Rose Elizabeth Supan, and Mort Shelby. The Book of the Black Earth, Number 1, Blood and Iron. Lightning split the night sky above the masts of the Bantu Ray. The driving wind shook the Carrick's timbers, and then darkness returned to smother everything. Mountains of black water surged around the ship and poured over the gunwales to wash across the deck. Sailors clung to their posts, with two brave souls aloft in the rigging trying to secure a loose topsail. Horace Del Rosa had signed on with the Ray as her master carpenter 3 months ago. Joining the war effort had seemed like an ideal way to flee from the ruins of his old life and start anew, but it hadn't worked out that way. Andrega, the bosun's mate, bare-chested and soaked to the bone, called to him across the deck.
How do you like the squall, landsman?
I've got every hand below on bilge pump, but Beloya says we have trouble.
Trouble, aye. We picked up an admirer.
Horace followed Andrega's pointing finger with his eyes, but couldn't see anything following him, although he knew other ships were out there. The Ray was part of a six-vessel flotilla, transporting soldiers from Avis to the Crusader state of Etonia, from there to take the fight to the unholy heathens of the East. They had risked a late passage across the Midland Sea to join the Great Crusade before winter. Another fork of lightning sizzled across the sky, and a huge shape materialized 100 fathoms behind the Carrick. The unfamiliar vessel was at least twice the size of the Bantu Ray and rigged for battle. Dark faces framed in ruddy lantern light peered down from her forecastle amid points of gleaming steel.
Ah, you see. We're running with the wind now, but soon we'll be fighting for our lives. Best make sure you're ready.
Horace looked again to the Ray's rigging. Several of her sails were torn away, flapping like angry wings, and the crew worked to take them in. A tall wave crashed against the hull, and the Carrick listed onto her side. Lightning flashed, and a burning sensation rippled down the center of his chest. Horace sagged against the open hatch as the afterimage of dancing lights faded from his vision. That last flash of lightning had been a ghastly green shade. He'd never seen anything like it. He rubbed his chest as the sudden urge to hit something came over him.
All hands!
The captain's cry lifted Horace to his feet. He ducked back through the hatch. Stumbling down the steps, he reached the main hold, which the Crusaders had converted into a barracks. His gaze went immediately to the seams, checking for leaks. A gray-haired sergeant sat on a footlocker near the front of the long deck, drawing a whetstone across the edge of his infantry sword.
How's it look topside?
Not good. There's an enemy ship closing on us. The captain wants everyone on deck.
Can we outrun it?
Maybe on a comm see if the ship is in top condition. But we've been taking a drubbing from the storm, and I'd say we're barely making 4 knots.
Most of these men can't even stand up without losing their bowels, much less fight.
Horace looked through the forest of swinging hammocks, where men tried to sleep amid the groaning wind. The sergeant looked at Horace's hands.
Those are some scars for a carpenter. They might make it hard to hold on to a blade when the sweat and blood start running. You'll want to find some gloves before the fighting begins, if it comes to that.
Not for me. I'll be below, keeping us afloat.
You believe all those things they say about Keshian warlocks? About how they're all eunuchs and the first thing they do when they capture a man is shear off his marbles? I'll tell you one thing, they won't take me alive. Not a chance.
Get them moving, Sergeant. We don't have much time.
Much obliged, son. Tell the captain I'll gather the men, but he needs to buy us more time.
Just hurry.
Horace started back up the companionway. Another bolt of ghoulish green light slashed across the sky. A wave lifted him up and plunged him down into a bath of icy blackness. Stunned, he tried to swim to the surface, but his limbs were slow to respond. He kicked until something hard rammed into his back. His mouth popped open and seawater rushed in. He fought against the darkness that threatened to descend over him. Then a quiet calm washed over him. The pain was soothing, and he sank down in the darkness. His last sensation was the current pulling him along, just another piece of jetsam in the cold of the deep. Horace awakened and sat up, heart hammering in his chest, as the memories came crashing back. The storm, the enemy ship, and then washing overboard.
But I'm alive.
Sweat soaked him under a thin white sheet, which was the only thing concealing his nakedness. He sat on a pallet on the floor in a small room about the same size as a ship's galley. The walls and ceiling were dried mud. There was a door near his feet and a slatted window over his head, through which entered a balmy sea breeze. His clothes were folded beside him, the navy blue shirt and black breeches of his uniform. His boots had been cleaned of salt and spray. He wanted to stand, but didn't think he had the strength. He couldn't remember anything after the storm.
Where am I? Etonia?
Smells of food rose from a tray beside his bed. He lifted the cloth cover to find a small loaf of brown bread and a clay cup. Horace lifted the cup. The amber liquid inside had an earthy smell. Too thirsty to care what it was, he drank, spilling some down his chin. The taste was bitter and malty, almost like ale, but heavier. The door opened and an old woman entered. Thin and bent over, she picked up the tray.
Pardon me. Can you tell me where...
The old woman carried the tray away without a glance at him, closing the door behind her. Horace reached for his shirt and put it on, then pulled on his breeches. He was starting to suspect he wasn't in Etonia, but somewhere south along the Acheshian shore, and that meant he was in trouble. His hands shook as he slipped on his boots. He had been a fool to join the crusade, even as a ship's crewman. He knew nothing of fighting. His life before had been filled with books and building plans. Steeling himself, Horace tried to stand up. His stomach clenched a little, but the discomfort went away once he was fully upright. He expected the door to be locked or otherwise secured, but it opened at his touch. In the larger room beyond, three people glanced up from seats around a low table. Like the cell where he had awakened, this room also had mud walls and ceiling, but the floor was covered in overlapping carpets woven in beautiful designs and colors. The people around the table included a man about Horace's age, a woman who might have been his wife, and a boy about 8 or 9 years old. All three had the same dusky complexion and curly black hair. The woman and boy wore undyed homespun clothing. The man was bare-chested, showing off a lean, wiry frame. He wore a white linen skirt and had an imposing black beard and deep-set eyes. Horace stood there, looking at the people, and they stared back at him. Then a curtain of beads parted, and the old woman came into the room. She carried a large clay bowl, from which came an appetizing aroma both sweet and spicy. She stopped when she saw Horace, and the man stood up.
Saralakti.
The old woman shuffled to the table. As she sat down, the man motioned for Horace to come as well. The table was lower than he was used to, and surrounded by plush cushions instead of chairs. But once he was settled, he found it quite comfortable. The mother uncovered the serving bowl and began ladling out portions. The man was served first, and the next bowl was set before Horace. He looked around for a fork, but there was nothing in front of him. The others held the bowls to their mouths and used their right hands like spoons. After watching them for a few seconds, Horace fell in with gusto. It tasted like a combination of savory and hot spices, much stronger than the usual cumin or cloves found in our nasi food. Horace ate as fast as he could shovel it in, devouring the entire bowl in moments. He watched the others eat, trying to learn as much as he could about them. They spoke little during the meal, and of course he couldn't understand a word of it. Their language was completely unlike our Nasi or Nemean, or the smattering of Altaian he spoke. Everything about this experience, sitting with this family, eating their food, felt odd.
Is it possible they're just trying to make me feel welcome? Why should they? I'm a stranger. No, there's some deception at play.
After a few minutes, Horace stood up. Every eye at the table followed him as he went to the door, but no one tried to stop him. Horace pulled on the wrought iron latch, and the door swung inward. He blinked as bright sunlight poured through the doorway. He started to step outside when two men appeared in his way. Both wore their hair cropped down to the scalp, leaving a short mat of black fuzz. They wore simple smocks and skirts, but each man also held a spear and a small round shield of animal hide stretched over a wooden frame. One of them raised his spear.
Sekano inhabitum!
Horace retreated behind the threshold. Beyond the armed men, he saw a village of wooden huts, reminding him of any number of fishing hamlets along the coastline of Arnos, except for the bronze-skinned people walking past. He glimpsed a hill on the far side of the village, topped by a house that was larger than the others. Constructed of brown brick, it appeared to be all one story, with a flat roof and arched windows. One of the guards pulled the door closed.
Isukanu?
Horace looked down at the old woman standing beside him, holding out a clay cup. The rest of the family watched from the table. He took the cup with a nod. The drink was cool and mild-tasting. Horace followed the old woman back to the table. The wife refilled his bowl and placed it before him. The father continued to watch him with an intense gaze. Horace's stomach sank as the husband leapt to answer the knock. Four men wearing burnished steel breastplates and conical helmets marched into the house and took up positions around the room. Short swords hung from their broad leather belts. Then another man entered the house. He wore a leather cuirass chased with silver accents. The pommel and guard of the curved sword at his side were silver too. By the deference shown to him, the new arrival was obviously in charge. The family all bowed to him, the father going down on one knee. The father and the man in command exchanged a few words. Horace sat, frustrated, while they talked and cast meaningful glances in his direction.
I can't understand a word you're saying. I'm just a sailor shipwrecked on your shore. Do you know what happened to my...
Sar Urukur Pulmaleb.
The commander drew his sword.
I don't know what you want!
The commander sheathed his weapon. Then he and his soldiers left the dwelling. The two peasant guards peeked inside with wide eyes before closing the door behind them. The father walked out through another beaded curtain, leaving Horace alone with the women and child. Horace got to his feet. He wasn't hungry anymore. No one paid him any attention as he went back to his small cell. Jiram reeled back with blood pouring into his right eye. He blinked it away as he retreated. He blocked a hard jab and grimaced as the iron spikes protruding from his opponent's gloves gouged long furrows down his forearm. Up in the stands, workaday freemen of the Empire watched as their betters sat in shaded wooden boxes along the top of the tiny arena. A blow to the ribs knocked the air out of his lungs and left stinging gashes along his side. Jiram covered up and circled away. His opponent was called the Lion. He was ferocious, young, and as strong as his namesake. With his light complexion and proud hawkish nose, he could have passed for a member of the upper caste except for his iron collar and the sigil, three diamonds joined in a triangular pattern branded on the right side of his face that marked him as a permanent slave, unable to ever regain his freedom again. Jiram didn't know the Lion's story, save that he'd been brought down from Chiresh for these games. That meant money had been invested in him, a lot of it. Jiram blocked a right hook that would have caved in his head, and more blood poured down his arms. As he stepped back from a straight-arm jab, his shoulders hit the rough boards of the arena's 8-foot-high partition. A hard punch to the gut nearly forced him to drop his guard. But he saw the follow-up to the head and slipped away. In one of the private boxes, a portly middle-aged man with deep brown skin was talking to an equally portly, slightly older patrician. The first man was Jiram's owner, Thraxes, so engrossed in conversation that he wasn't even watching the bout. Jiram slapped away another punch and continued his slow retreat around the pit. The familiar twinge in his lower back from an old injury climbed up his spine, making every movement that much more painful. He glanced up to the private boxes at the wrong moment, and his opponent charged. Jiram covered his face as he backpedaled. But a couple of punches got through, drawing more blood. His feet got tangled up, and he fell hard on his backside. A kick to the back as he rolled over sent jangling shocks of pain down his legs. His opponent stood over him with arms raised to the crowd. Thraxes was still engrossed in his discussion. Jiram got to his feet as the lion paraded around the arena. His opponent didn't give him time to fully recover before charging at him again. Jiram circled away to his left, always the left, and glanced up. Thraxes was now standing in front of his seat. With a bored expression, the slave owner yawned and scratched his ample belly. That was the signal.
About time, you fat bastard.
The lion unleashed another straight punch. His eyes widened as Jiram caught the fist with an open hand. Air exploded from the lion's mouth as Jiram drove his other fist into the younger man's ribs. A punch to the back of the ear dropped the lion to his knees, and the next one laid him out flat with blood trickling down his branded cheek. Jiram knelt down and wrapped both arms around the lion's neck. With a heave, he twisted until the spine snapped. A few copper coins fell from the audience as Jiram walked to the gate. But he ignored them as he traveled down the dark tunnel to the slave cells. The sweltering chamber at the bottom of the tunnel was filled with men, some standing, others sitting on benches. Most wore little more than a loincloth and a layer of sweat. Moldy sawdust covered the floor. The veteran gladiators called this area the temple, for all the prayers these walls had heard. Jiram sat down and peeled off his gloves. His arms were lacerated by dozens of cuts and punctures. More injuries crisscrossed his torso, but none of them looked serious. A comely slave boy approached with a basket of bandages torn from old blood-stained clothes. Jiram leaned back as his wounds were smeared with a thick liniment and wrapped up. A bulky Akeshian called Fat Rabuk shuffled past.
You live to fight another day, Jiram, eh?
So it seems.
That is a good thing, my friend.
Perhaps. The gods smile on you, Rabuk, and grant you a swift death when the time comes.
The gods can go bugger themselves for all I care.
As Rabuk headed up the tunnel toward the arena, Jiram closed his eyes. Every inch of his body ached. His bones ached. Yet the cuts and the bruises would fade. 7 months of fighting in these small-town arenas, and before that 20-odd years of selling his sword from the steppes of Skavia to the shores of the Western Ocean, soldiering under so many flags he couldn't remember half of them, had left him with a weariness inside that never healed. When his company was captured after a campaign along the Asuran border, every fighting man was given the choice of chains or crucifixion. Jiram chose slavery. Now he was still fighting for money, but this time with a brand on his face and an iron collar around his neck. Yet it was better than the alternative. Jiram opened his eyes as his owner entered the temple. Thraxes waded among the gladiators. For an owner, he was well-liked in the pits. The slave boy darted away.
Jiram, my champion. The mighty warrior from the south wins again. Very impressive and very lucrative.
And you'll be keeping my share again.
Ah, Jiram, you know slaves are forbidden to keep money. Otherwise, I would be honored to share the winnings. But one day, perhaps you will be free, and then you will be a rich man.
I'd settle for killing you.
Is that any way to treat the owner who has just secured you a fight in Sekhatun?
Go away before I do something we both regret.
I swear upon the Sun Lord himself, this is the truth! The man I was sitting beside today, do you know who he is? Mituban, chief proctor to Lord Esiratu. He was very impressed with our performance.
With my performance, you mean?
Well, yes, of course. He said he would speak with his magnificence about bringing you to the Imperial Gladiator Circuit. Sekhatun isn't Siasa, but it is a damn sight better than this cesspool.
You're selling me?
Think of the opportunity to fight in the Imperial Circuit before all the lords and ladies. You might even earn your freedom someday. Then who will you thank, eh?
Bring me some beer.
Only the best for my champion.
As the man left, Jiram considered his future. More fighting. More crowds craving blood. More pain until the day he fought someone better. Then, if he was fortunate, a quick death and a shallow grave. Jiram climbed to his feet, feeling every day of his 36 years. Fat Rabak emerged from the tunnel covered in blood and sweat. His right hand was bare, the fighting gauntlet torn away, but he was smiling broadly enough to light up the dim chamber.
You live to fight again.
Aye, and tonight I will feast and fuck and wake up tomorrow to do it all again.
Jiram walked through a low doorway and down a narrow corridor toward the gladiator cells where, if Thraxes wasn't lying, a pitcher of beer waited for him. Maybe he'd send for the slave boy to come visit him, if he didn't fall asleep once his head touched the mattress. On the third day after he awoke in the village, Horus was allowed out of the house where he'd been confined since his capture. He didn't know what had changed, but he was grateful for the reprieve. Walking along dirt pathways between the huts, he felt almost normal. His weakness had left him by the second morning, thanks to a steady diet of bread, rice, and the malty beer these people drank with every meal. This morning, he'd been given a new set of clothes in the native style, a skirt of homespun weave, a lightweight tunic, and a pair of sturdy sandals. Two peasant spearmen shadowed his footsteps. Horace tried to ignore them as much as possible. The beach was half a mile on the other side of the large hill that dominated the center of the village. Horace shaded his eyes and looked up to the house atop the tor. No flag flew from the rooftop. Horace looked out to the water, hoping to see a set of familiar sails, but the skyline was unbroken. The sea was sapphire blue under the bright sunlight. White-capped waves slapped against the shore, empty except for several fishing boats. He didn't know exactly where he was, but he guessed it was well south of Etonia. The fleet must have swung off course during the storm and run into Akeshian waters. Horace turned to his guards. With a nod to them, Horace headed back. A group of armored soldiers was gathered outside the home of his hosts when they arrived. When they sighted the walking party, the soldiers surrounded Horace and goaded him onward. They turned down a path that led to a large circle of bare ground outside the village. A dirt road led away to the east. Several peasant men in simple smocks and shirts stood in a ragged line beside the circle. Each carried a wicker basket strapped to his back. Horace was made to wait while the soldiers stood about. An older soldier in heavy armor walked ahead of a procession of oxen. The animals were piled with bundles and boxes. Behind them rode a man on horseback. Horace recognized him as the commander who had come to the host's dwelling 3 days back. He looked more regal atop his white steed. A round steel shield, its face polished to a mirror shine, hung on the saddle. The commander gave a signal, and the soldiers formed a square around Horace. With hand motions, they urged him to start walking down the road. He gazed down its length and saw nothing but barren land stretching into the unknown east. One of the soldiers, who had two bronze slashes emblazoned on his breastplate, looked to the commander and then hurried over to Horace. He pointed down the road.
Kanu Alaktasa!
Horace crossed his arms and stayed where he was. The marked soldier grabbed him by the shoulder with one hand and shoved. Horace kept on his feet by twisting around. Everyone was watching. Horace stood up straight and crossed his arms again. The officer's face bunched into a fierce expression. He drew back his shield. Horace lifted his arms to protect his face, but a shout rang out.
Kimasalak!
Horace braced himself as the commander climbed down from his horse. The commander walked over to the officer. He struck the man across the face with an open hand. The officer stood at strict attention without responding. The commander turned to Horace and merely pointed down the road. Horace lowered his arms. He could continue to resist and probably be tied over the back of one of the oxen or fall in line. By the time the commander climbed back into the saddle, Horace decided that going along was the wiser course. He started walking. After a while, he calmed down and started to enjoy the sensation of moving in a specific direction. Since waking up in this strange land, he felt lost. He still didn't know where he was going, but he was going somewhere. The road was mainly packed sand, although not as impressive as the stone highways of his homeland. Relics from the days when the Nemean Empire had ruled most of the civilized world, the road was straight and level. But there were no markers that he could see, no way to tell what lay ahead. The soldiers set an easy pace, spears resting on their shoulders. They had the look of professionals. Their gear was well maintained, and they possessed the easy manner of men long accustomed to their duty. The officer, who stalked around the formation as they marched, actually appeared younger than the rest of the soldiers. The commander was younger, too. Horace guessed that they were both in their mid-20s, which would make them about the same age as he was. To hear the soldiers on the Bantu Ray tell it, there had always been hostility between the East and West, but a sudden increase in piracy on the Midland Sea a few years ago had convinced the Western nations to expand their navies. When Arnasi warships inevitably encountered Akeshian vessels, the conflict turned to war. No one was sure which side attacked first, but soon afterward the fathers of the true church preached that Akeshia was an evil realm that needed to be conquered and converted. When Prelate Benevolence II called for a holy war, the faithful responded in the tens of thousands, boarding ships to seek their salvation in a far-off land. As they traveled inland, the ground became rocky and barren. The few trees to be seen were dry, leafless things with claw-like branches. An hour past midday, even walking had become a chore, and Horace found himself swaying with every step. A peasant walked down the line with a bucket and gave every man a drink from a ladle. When it was Horace's turn, he gulped down his share. The commander remained in the saddle while a peasant watered his steed. The rest of the villagers sat on their heels at the rear of the group, weighed down by their burdens. After a couple of minutes, the officer signaled. The villagers jumped to their feet and got back in line. The soldiers formed up, and the company set off again. By the time that the sun sank behind the plains, the commander had called for a halt. Horace lay on the hot ground, exhausted. It would have been easy to fall asleep, but he didn't. He estimated they had traveled about 20 miles today. Tomorrow they would likely travel 20 more, getting farther away from the coast with every step. He couldn't let that happen if he ever wanted to see home again. He had to escape. Horace cracked open his eyes. The peasants had bedded down around the fire. Most of the soldiers had done the same, except for the commander, who sat apart from the rest, leaning back against his saddle on the ground. People fell asleep one by one, all except the sentry, who marched in a wider circle with his spear propped on his shoulder. Horace counted as the trooper performed his watch. Each circuit around the camp took him between 80 and 100 breaths to complete. Horace lay still as the sentry came around again. When the man had passed by, Horace stole a quick glance around the camp. All heads were on the ground. This was his chance. He crawled away from the fire on his hands and knees. Darkness enveloped him within 10 paces. After another 10, he stopped and listened. There was nothing to indicate that he'd been seen leaving. No cry of alarm. He took a moment to orient himself, using the rising moon to locate due west. Then he took off. The light of the stars and moon was enough to guide him across the uneven ground. Following the road directly was too obvious. They'd catch him for sure. His captors might expect him to head north toward Etonia, so he chose to go south for now. He trotted at a quick pace but did not run. He had to conserve his strength. Come morning, he wanted to be back at the coast. He would avoid settlements as he made his way westward, except for stealing what food and water he needed at night. While he was occupied with making plans for survival, his right foot caught in a hole he thought was just a shadow. He suppressed a yell of surprise as he pitched forward. He caught himself on his hands, and something pierced his left palm. He climbed to his feet, clutching that hand. He didn't feel any blood, but it hurt like hell. Massaging the injury, he started off again, this time being more careful of divots. He watched the ground in front of his feet. A bright light appeared from a shuttered lantern to reveal a rider on horseback. The commander. Horace sprinted to his right. The commander wheeled his steed around and raced alongside him. Horace zigged around a low bristle bush and tried to put some distance between them. He was watching the commander's approach out of the corner of his eye when something hit him square in the chest and he fell backward. A dark silhouette stood over him holding a club. Horace watched as more soldiers appeared. They picked him up by the arms and dragged him back. The peasants were all awake when they returned. Horace wondered what was going to happen next. The commander conferred with the officer, and then one soldier, the one who had been on sentry duty, was seized. He was stripped of his armor, and ropes were tied around each of his wrists. As two soldiers held his arms outstretched to their fullest extension, the officer produced a short, thick whip with four leather tails. The punishment was swift and brutal. Horace flinched at the first strike, which tore a long furrow across the sentry's shoulders. He started to turn his head, but a soldier kneeling behind him grabbed him by the hair and held a dagger to his throat, forcing him to face forward. He had to watch as the whip lashed again and again until the victim's back was a mass of oozing stripes. The sentry did not scream, and when the punishment was over, the man was released. He crawled over to his pile of gear and collapsed. The soldier holding Horace let him go. He glanced around as he rubbed his neck where the dagger had pricked him. The camp was returning to how it had been before, although this time three soldiers were put on sentry duty, two patrolling in circuits, while the third stood nearby, watching over Horace. The peasants were lying down again. Some had even fallen asleep already. The commander was back in his blanket while a soldier groomed his horse. It was all orderly and neat. Weary, deep down in his bones, Horace lay down on his side facing the fire and drifted into a troubled sleep. He awoke with a sense of ominous dreams, convoluted and portentous, but could remember none of them. The ground was cool beneath him. The officer walked among the group, kicking the men awake. Water and bread were distributed. The commander sat apart on a small cushion, eating something from a wooden bowl. When everyone had been fed, they started off again. A soldier remained by Horace's side from that point on. The next day, they sighted a river, mud brown and wider across than a bow shot. It came up from the south and ran due east. Small boats plied its waters, some with sails and others powered by long paddles at the stern. Huge fields of gold and brown stretched from its banks for miles on both sides. Peasants in long skirts walked among the rows of wheat and barley, plucking weeds and ministering to an ingenious system of ditches and wooden dams that conducted water from one field to another. Large, hive-like buildings with no windows were scattered among the fields. Horace was so intent on his surroundings that he didn't notice the town they were approaching until the officer gave an order, and the column picked up the pace. Buildings appeared a couple of miles ahead of them. The settlement sat on a table-flat plain. The outer wall formed a perfect square, protecting an area not quite as large as Tyne's, which was small as northern ports went, but many towers and narrow rooftops were nestled together inside the walls. The company closed the distance in less than an hour. Horace was soaked in sweat by the time they reached the walls. The gate guarding the road was open, but a squad of men-at-arms in steel breastplates stood before it. The commander reined up before the sentries and quietly exchanged words. The sentries finally waved the column through. Passing under the gate's shaded archway was a blessing, but a momentary one. The heat met him again on the other side as he was herded through crowded streets lined with rows of cloth awnings and recessed doorways. Because of the closeness of the avenues and the height of the buildings around him, some rising 5 or 6 stories above the street, Horace couldn't make out much of the town beyond the jagged skyline. Most of the buildings were constructed of brick and had flat roofs. The streets were dried mud, pitted with potholes and wheel ruts, though they were cleaner than he might have guessed. Horace had never seen so many people pressed together, not even in the markets of Avis. The commander led the party down several twisting streets until he stopped before a door that didn't look much different than any other. It was painted green, but the town had doors and window shutters of all colors. Horace noted a pictogram drawn above the lintel of a black horseshoe with the open end down and a horizontal line drawn under the legs. The commander went inside. The rest of the soldiers fanned out around the doorway, facing outward, while the peasants crouched in the shade of the building. Horace leaned against a wall and wondered when the pleasantries would end. For the most part, his captors had treated him well, but he was an enemy on their soil. The door opened, and three young men with short-cropped hair hurried out. Each wore a long skirt, like the men in the fields, but of bright white cloth embroidered with crimson scrollwork along the hem, and no shirts. The young men ushered the soldiers inside with many bows and nods, and they brought Horace with them. The door led into a roofless courtyard paved in mosaic tile. There was a small fountain against the wall to Horace's right, surrounded by leafy plants and young trees planted in clay pots. Horace looked up to several balconies above, their iron handrails framing a square of azure sky. The commander entered through a wide archway on the other side of the courtyard, accompanied by a heavyset man with a sagging gray mustache. The hem of his simple robe swept across the floor. The commander indicated Horace, and the older man clapped his hands. Two large men wearing cloth kilts and leather harnesses entered. Each had an iron collar around his neck and a short sword hanging from his side. They came forward and grasped Horace by his arms. He didn't have time to resist before they hauled him through a side archway. They tossed him into a small room where he was able to see by way of a narrow window in the ceiling. He stood in the center of the cell as the guards barred the entry from the outside. The floor and walls were hard stone blocks. The air was cool down here, at least. The ceiling was just a couple of inches over his head, which made him want to duck. He inspected the window, but it was far too small to allow for any chance of escape. He lowered himself to the floor and sat with his elbows propped on his raised knees, staring at the door. Jerome looked out through the iron bars of the wagon as it rolled down the hard-beaten roadway. The sun was only halfway to its zenith, but already the day was sweltering. Not so hot as the desert, yet still enough to drive a man mad. His scalp itched, too, where the hair was growing in. He'd kept it shaved for years, but he didn't think anyone was going to give him a razor after what he'd done. Breaking the jaw of a smart-mouthed drover on the first day of the journey had been satisfying, but now they kept him in the cage night and day. Standing up, he met the gaze of Umgaya in the next cage. Their wagons were linked together and pulled by the same train of oxen. Umgaya winked at him with the single eye in the center of her forehead. At least he thought it was a wink. With a cyclops, it was always hard to tell.
It's soon time for another show.
Beyond her wagon, the brick walls of a settlement emerged from the dusty savanna. Another village, another show. Chief Proctor Metuban was, among other things, a procurer for his master, Lord Isiratu. The wagon train held tribute from a dozen holdmasters, as well as some curiosities that Metuban had encountered during his trek around the territory. At every stop along the road to Sekhatun, the caravan displayed its oddities to the common people. When the caravan reached the village, a crowd had gathered. The wagon stopped at the village center and pulled into a semicircle. Caravan guards went around, watering and feeding the animals. The doors of the lead wagon opened, and Chief Proctor Metuban appeared, wearing a long robe of ivory white with a crimson sash around the middle. The village elders kept their distance until Metuban beckoned them closer.
Come and see the wonders I have collected for our lord and master! Come and see the cannibal gladiator from the dark heart of Abyssia and the fabled Cyclops of Sidon!
That night, as the caravan made camp, wagon drivers and guards sat around the fires, passing skins of beer back and forth. Jerome wrapped his shirt around the lock of his cage door. Earlier in the day, while the guards grew lax under the afternoon sun, he'd grasped a fist-sized rock from the ground and hidden it under his shirt. He watched the sentries. When they wandered to the far side of the camp, past the chief proctor's pavilion, its white silk walls glowing in the moonlight, he slammed the rock against the lock. Shiram hunkered down and waited, but no one came to investigate. He swung again. Shiram waited for a few seconds and then pushed. The cage door swung open. Still clutching the rock, he hopped down. He took a step, but halted as he saw Umgaya watching him. She sat near the edge of her cage, wrapped in a blanket. He went to her door. She watched as he tested the bars. The lock on her cage was older than his. Shiram hit it. The lock's metal face bent on the first blow and cracked open on the second. He opened the door and held out a hand, but she backed away. Shiram felt a whip's lash across his shoulders. He turned and swung at the sentry standing behind him, the stone colliding with the guard's temple. The guardsman crumpled to the ground without uttering a sound. Shiram stood over the body, weighing the stone in his hand. He tensed at the touch on his flayed shoulder.
You must go, gladiator.
Come with me.
No! Out in the world, I would just be a beggar, not even fit for a whore. Mituban feeds me well, and his men leave me alone.
Before Shiram could stop her, Umgaya scurried back into her wagon and closed the door. With a last look at her, he turned toward freedom and tensed as several shapes emerged from the darkness. The sentries hemmed him in, their spears leveled. Shiram looked over his shoulder. Three guards brandishing stout clubs came around the corner of his wagon. Shiram opened his hand, let the rock fall to the ground, and braced himself. The club, striking the middle of his back, still drove the wind from his lungs and knocked him off his feet. The guards dragged him back toward his cage.
Here, let me see him.
They held Shiram up by his arms as the chief proctor came out from his pavilion.
What's all this?
Two sentries hauled the body of the man Shiram had killed into the light. Mituban's gaze went from the corpse to Shiram. Mituban stepped closer.
How dare you raise your hands to one of my servants, slave? You are the property of Lord Isiratu. I can see you're nothing more than a beast, unfit for the company of men. I would have you executed, but the pleasure belongs to his lordship. Believe me, before the end you will beg for death.
With a violent shudder, Shiram threw off the men holding his arms. A red haze blurred his vision, but through the fog he could see Mituban on the ground, grasping at Jaram's large hands clutched around his neck. Shiram wrenched, and the chief proctor's struggles ceased. Shiram felt a red-hot pain at the back of his head. As he slumped forward, the last thing he saw was Mituban's frozen expression of complete surprise. Horus was dreaming the familiar dream again.
Hold on!
He pushed through the crowd. Everywhere, people were jostling and shoving as they pressed toward the gates. Men, women, and children, the entire population of the trade quarter, were all trying to get out at once. He squeezed Sari's hand as he looked back.
We'll make it out!
The terror was plain in her wide blue eyes. That same fear was reflected in every face around them as word of the plague's arrival spread throughout the port town of Tynes. The crowd was edging toward a riot, and his family was stuck in the center of it. Their little son Joseph squirmed in his mother's arms.
Be still, Joseph. We're going on a trip.
The boy struggled to get out of his mother's grasp, but Sari hugged him tighter.
We have to get out of the city. What if they've closed the gates?
Sari looked into Horus's eyes. He was forced to concede that they weren't getting anywhere. He couldn't even see the walls yet, and he was beginning to fear that the nearest gates had been closed.
They wouldn't do that. We would send thousands of people to die.
The air was humid from the press of bodies. Some people were shoving each other. He had to get his family out. His gaze strayed to the cliffs overlooking the town, the pale cliffs of Tynes. And he knew where they had to go.
Come on!
Horus!
He pulled Sari and Joseph out of the street, into the shelter of a dim alleyway. He knew the general direction they needed to go, but they'd have to hurry. They reached the waterfront, and Horus wanted to slap himself. As a shipwright, escaping Tynes on an outgoing vessel should have been his first thought. He scanned the many berths, and a sinking sensation pooled in his gut at the sight of so many ships that had already put out to sea, their billowing sails waving goodbye. Flames danced at several spots on the piers where other vessels had been put to the torch. He could guess why. Signs of plague on board. While soldiers in city livery set another ship alight, clusters of sailors crowded the boardwalk, waving their fists, no doubt as terrified as he was at the idea of being stranded here.
I think I know someone who will.
Horace, do you think we'll find anyone to take us on?
Little Joseph was wide-eyed at the sight of the ships.
That's right, my boy. We're gonna ride in a ship.
Squeezing Sari's hand, Horace led them along the quay. Fishermen were hauling their belongings aboard their shallow craft in preparation to depart. Horace kept moving with long strides, trusting his instincts. Calvert would take them, if he was still at port. A weight lifted off Horace's chest as he sighted a familiar yellow mast at the end of the waterfront. The Sea Spray was still nestled in her berth. He had spent 2 weeks refitting the merchant frigate, and during that time he had gotten to know her crew. He hoped they remembered him fondly. They passed a gang of sailors loading barrels onto the Spray. Captain Calvert stood on the ship's waist. Horace raised his free hand.
Captain! Captain Calvert!
The middle-aged sea captain squinted in their direction. He held up a finger to the marine standing beside him with a loaded crossbow. Horace stopped in his tracks and gathered Sari behind him.
Captain, it's me, Horace DelRosa.
A smile creased the captain's lips.
Shipwright! I'd ask what you've been doing down here at a time like this, and with that pretty lass who must be the wife you've been telling us about. But I think mayhap I can guess.
We need passage out of Tynes.
Calvert climbed down from the ship.
Aye, I can fathom that much. But there's orders come down from his lordship saying that any ship takes on townsfolk as passengers will be set alight.
Please, Captain. They've shut the gates. I can't keep my family here. It's not safe.
I understand what you're going through, but that don't change the weather if you take my meaning.
Captain, I don't have much money, but if you'll take my family to your next port, I'll serve as your ship's carpenter for a year, without wages.
Oh, I'd like to help, son, but...
I'm begging you, sir. If I'm serving on your ship, that makes me crew, so no laws are broken. My wife can wash and cook, too.
All right. I can't leave you behind to face this unholy mess. Get on board.
Horace clapped a hand on the captain's arm before leading Sari and Joseph up the gangplank. Sailors hustled across the deck carrying tackle and provisions, hauling on lines and scrambling through the rigging. Horace pulled his wife into a spot of relative calm beside the forecastle ladder and hugged her close.
We made it.
Aye. Soon we'll be underway.
Where will we go?
It doesn't matter. We're safe.
The opening door woke him. Horace jerked upright as two soldiers entered his cell. By the light coming down the narrow window chute, he guessed it must be morning. He didn't resist when the soldiers indicated he should come with them. They went outside to the street where the commander sat astride his steed. The rest of the soldiers were assembled behind their leader. After a few moments, the company got underway. The streets were packed with people, mainly commoners, carrying produce, driving domesticated goats and oxen. The company paused at an intersection of broad avenues as a pair of palanquins with gauzy silk curtains crossed in front of them. The men bearing them were naked, save for breechcloth and sandals. Horace noticed that each bearer also wore an iron collar. He hadn't made the connection at the townhouse between the old man and his muscular bodyguards, but now it was clear. Slaves. Slavery wasn't unknown. The practice had been legal centuries ago under the old Nemean Empire, but many of the Western nations outlawed it after they broke free of the imperial yoke. Yet slavery was evidently still alive and well here in the East. The company entered a large open square. The palace directly across from Horace was by far the most ostentatious building he'd ever seen. Though not very tall, 3 stories at most, it sprawled across the entire length of the square with a double row of columns supporting an impressive entablature. The company made their way to face a line of soldiers guarding the entrance of the Grand Palace. The commander dismounted to present a small clay tablet, and the soldiers waved them through. After being escorted by the soldiers through an atrium and up a flight of stairs to the second floor, Horace was ushered through a doorway into a spacious chamber. Chill air met him at the threshold. A high ceiling and large windows along the far wall made the room feel open, as if they had gone outside onto a shaded veranda. But the breeze was not enough to explain the sudden drop in temperature.
It has to be my mind playing tricks. Maybe I've suffered some kind of heat exhaustion.
Shivering slightly, Horus followed his escort farther into the chamber. The floor was pale hardwood, polished to a high sheen. Three men sat on cushioned divans, with sentries and slaves posted along the walls. The man seated in the middle had a gray mustache and beard, both trimmed and brushed neatly, but his head was completely bald. He wore a brocaded shirt with gold stitching that couldn't disguise his stocky build, and a long skirt down to his ankles, all in black silk. Wide pads flared out from his round shoulders like wings. The man sitting on the left was also bald, but his gleaming scalp was stamped with several tattoos in carmine ink. His robes were golden yellow with ivory buttons down the front and tied with a white sash. The third man was the youngest of the group, perhaps 15 or 16 years of age, but he already had a full mustache. Of the three, he was the only one who still sported a full head of hair, pulled back in an oiled queue. The young man's eyes were a light, almost clear shade of brown. The commander bowed. The older man greeted him with a nod and indicated a spot on the floor beside them. A slave scurried over with a cushion, and the commander sat down with his ankles crossed. No one offered Horus a cushion. He stood while the seated men talked. From time to time, they glanced in his direction. When the discussion was finished, the yellow-robed man turned to Horus and shocked him by speaking in fluent, if slightly stilted, Arnasi.
What is your name?
I'm Horus. Who is...
Galactica Horus Minu.
Yellow Robe translated before Horus could get out his question.
You are part of the Arnasi fleet sent from Avis, yes?
Yes. Where am I?
How does your nation intend to invade the land of the Black Earth?
What's that?
The Empire which you call Akeshia.
Who are you? And how do you come to speak Arnasi? No one else around here seems to.
I am Nasir et Alamun Amu, counselor to Lord Isirtu.
Nasir nodded to the elder man in the center seat.
I serve as a translator as well as his lordship's spiritual guide.
So why am I here? What do you plan on doing with me?
Nasir turned his head as the older man spoke.
Lord Isirtu requires that you draw a map of all the invader strongholds in Etonia and along the northern shore of the Great Sea from Myktonas.
My ship sank off the coast 5 days ago. Do you know if anyone else survived?
Lord Isirtu requires that...
Damn you, tell me if anyone else survived!
Horus noticed the younger man watching Lord Isirtu intently with his light eyes. The youth hadn't said anything up to this point, but he must be important if he was sitting here with the Lord. Horus addressed the youth.
Please, all I want is to know if any of my countrymen survived.
The others stopped talking. Then Lord Isirtu nodded.
One other foreigner was found on the beach, but he died not long after.
So that was it. He was alone. Without preamble, he sat down on the floor, hunched over his folded legs. The four seated men gazed at him in astonishment. The commander, his face turning crimson, reached for his sword, but a terse word from the Lord stopped him.
Lord Isirtu wishes to know why you addressed his heir, Lord Ubar.
I didn't know what else to do. He just seemed, I don't know, decent.
The young man spoke to his father, and then Lord Isirtu responded. Nasir looked to Horus.
My lord repeats his request that you divulge the locations and strengths of your invader strongholds.
Are you a damned parrot?
Pardon?
Never mind. Tell your lord I have no information. I don't know of any strongholds in this part of the world because we never made landfall on account of the storm. And furthermore, tell his lordship that even if I did know these things, I wouldn't tell him for all the gold in the world. Now, if you're going to kill me, just get it over with.
As Nasir translated, Horus was focused on Lord Isirtu. Then the commander and Nasir spoke, and their gazes locked in a battle of wills. Horus felt a strange pressure across his forehead, stretching from temple to temple. Yet within moments, Horus felt a strange pressure across his forehead, stretching from temple to temple. He started to reach up to touch it when another spot began to throb behind his left ear. Together, they hurt like the worst headache he'd ever had in his life. He tried to ignore the pain, but it only increased. Then he saw a peculiar expression on Isiritu's face, as if he were looking at some place far away in the distance, even though their gazes were still entangled. It was unsettling, and a strange thought crossed Horace's mind.
He's doing this to me.
He was ready to discard the thought, yet it might also explain the coolness of this chamber. Magic.
No, that's crazy. There's no such thing.
However, the more the pressure in his head grew, the more he began to believe it might be true. The Lord was affecting him without touching him.
He's touching me with some damned sorcery.
He'd heard tales of Eastern witchery, but experiencing it firsthand was a far different matter. His eyes held captive, Horace couldn't see anything except Isiritu's face, rigid with effort. He tried to move, to break the contact, but his body didn't respond. He was trapped as the pressure in his head increased. A fold of skin in the corner of the Lord's mouth was widening. In less time than it took to draw breath, it split open into a raw red crevice. A bead of blood welled from the cut. Horace watched it dribble down the Lord's chin. Then a torrent of anger, lying just beneath the surface of Horace's emotions, flared up inside him. All of a sudden, Horace's arms and legs were free of the eerie paralysis. He leapt without thinking, diving toward the Lord with both hands extended. The soldiers failed to react in time to stop him. Horace's first punch landed on Lord Isiritu's flabby face. The nobleman fell backward. Horace was hauled off Lord Isiritu and dropped on his back. There was no sign of what had grabbed him, but his tunic was wet around the middle. He started to get back up, ready to renew the fight until a dozen spears and swords were leveled at him. A shudder racked his body as the powerful impulse to kill receded, leaving him weak and confused. The soldiers and bodyguards looked ready to murder him out of hand. The commander was on his feet with sword drawn, his face red and angry. Nasir and Lord Isiritu looked aghast, but the young lordling appeared neither shocked nor upset. Instead, his expression appeared curious. The soldiers closed in around Horace. He curled up to protect himself, but they merely picked him up and carried him out of the chamber. Horace's new subterranean cell was not as large as the last one, and the lack of windows left it decidedly darker. The walls were stone blocks fitted together with very thin lines of mortar. He could barely reach the ceiling on his tiptoes. He had been given an old blanket, which he used as a pallet over the cold floor stones. He went to the door. It was heavy with rough beams bound in rusty iron.
Why in the Almighty's name did I attack Isiritu? It was the worst thing I could have done. Now they're going to cut off my marbles, followed by my head.
Horace pounded on the door. He listened for footsteps or voices, but nothing came through the thick beams. The door swung open. Harsh yellow light from a lantern blinded him, and he retreated a few steps with his hands held over his face.
Minu Shaman.
Water. I need some damned water.
Minu Shaman.
The turnkey, or whoever he was, slammed the door. Frustrated and more tired than before, Horace sat down on his blanket. He dozed off with his back against a wall. He was awakened abruptly. Instead of the jailer, a slim man entered. He wore only a simple linen kilt and leather sandals and carried a candle instead of a lamp. The man set something down on the floor. Horace stood up.
Can you help me?
Then he noticed the iron collar around the man's neck. Another slave. The slave left without saying a word. Horace lunged for the door, but the turnkey reappeared. He inspected the bowl the man had left on the floor. Sitting on the blanket, he dipped his fingers inside and felt a cold, sticky goo. He tasted it with the tip of his tongue. The substance had a consistency like gruel, but no flavor. He finished the bowl in three large finger scoops before he remembered the cup. It held tepid water. He gulped it down. Then he sat on the floor. With nothing else to do, he drifted off again. The opening door jarred him awake. He sat up and blinked as a pair of soldiers entered. They brought him out to a walled courtyard. The sky was glorious blue like a sheet of glass without a trace of clouds. The clay pavement was hot, but after the chill of his cell, Horace reveled in the warmth. A line of 20 or so men and women waited in the courtyard under guard, chained together by the neck. They varied in age from young adult to a couple old enough to be his grandparents. All of them appeared to be Akeshian, or Easterners at any rate. Horace was hauled to the end of the line where a squat man in a leather apron waited. The smith held up an iron collar, open on one side. Horace tried to pull back, but the guards held him still. The cool metal slid around his neck, and the collar was hammered closed. When the guards finally released him, he put his hands to his neck. The collar was thicker than his thumb and heavy. A rivet sealed the opening where it fit together. The soldiers connected Horace to the back of the line by attaching a heavy chain to his collar. None of the other chained people bothered to look back at him. A large wagon arrived, pulled by a team of four oxen. The wagon was painted scarlet, with brass accents and tall wheels. Two drivers sat in the front, one holding the reins, the other an unstrung bow with a quiver of arrows between his feet. A company of soldiers marched behind the wagon in double file. A large hand parted the gauzy curtains that covered the wagon's window, and Lord Isiritu peered out. His son and the priest sat inside with him. Suddenly, a commotion erupted from the doorway leading to the dungeon cells. The soldiers in the courtyard drew wooden truncheons from their belts. As they stepped toward the entrance, a large man in armor tumbled out, skidding across the ground. The soldiers poured into the doorway. Eight soldiers marched out the doorway, escorting a man out into the courtyard. The prisoner was huge, almost a head taller than any of his captors. Black stubble covered his shaved head. Slabs of muscle bunched under ebony skin. His face was marred by the marks of a recent branding. Blood trickled from a split lower lip. An officer gestured, and the aproned smith released Horace from the chain. Then they shoved the giant, who was already collared, in front of Horace, and both of them were joined to the coffle line. The collar chain compelled Horace to keep up or risk being dragged along. The wagon driver flicked the reins and started the vehicle moving, followed by the column of soldiers, out a wide gate to the street.